Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr. And Christine not with us. This is getting recorded the week she's in sales meeting. Yeah, that. So she's not with us this week. But our guest this week is Melinda Cole of Merry Wind Farm. Hi, Melinda.
Hello. How are you?
Doing okay. Thanks for joining us here. Now, Merry Wind Farm.
Yes.
That's where you live.
Yes, it is.
Name of your business, but also where you live out in Ohio there. So that's how do we get Merry Wind? Just enjoy the breezes through the fields?
Well, the farmhouse is actually kind of on the top of the hill. It's one of the highest spots in Miami County, Ohio. And when my parents originally purchased this farm, it had previously been named Merry Wind Farm.
Oh, okay.
And the previous owners had little children. I'm just suspecting that it was the little children that came up with a cute name, and because it's so windy here.
Yeah.
That's just a guess. I mean, it's not an original or historic name for it.
Yeah. Well, it's just a cheerful name. It's nice.
Yes, it is.
It's nice. So conjures up nice mental images. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So, all right. Now you're in the reproduction sampler world, and maybe I have this dead wrong. Most people will do reproduction samplers and stitch models, but you stitch other people's samplers. That's not always normal, is it?
I was a sampler stitcher before I started my reproduction business.
Okay.
I still stitch other people's samplers when I can. I mostly wrapped up in just stitching my own models.
Okay.
With my charting them and then stitching and trying to do all the publishing, I only managed to come out with two or three a year. But yeah. I do always try to do other stitching. I just finished a large one from Hands Across the Sea. And
yeah, that's redundant. Large sampler from Hands Across the Sea.
Yes.
That's redundant, yes.
But I'm always working on another sampler also. I just don't get nearly as much time to stitch on things that I'm stitching just for myself for the fun of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably not alone there. So stitching when you were a child?
No, my mother was quite a seamstress, and I grew up sewing by hand and sewing by machine and made my clothes. And then I also was a quilter and got into quilting.
Oh, there you go.
And I still do some of that, but once again, not nearly as much as I'd like to. And when I was 21, I was on a vacation up in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I don't remember the name of a shop, but I stopped in a little tiny shop and purchased one of the old Paragon stamped motto samplers that say God bless our home.
Uh-huh.
from the 80s, and stitched that. And it was in horrible, awful 80s colors, but I so loved I love stitching it, and back then those weren't awful colors.
Right.
So that was the beginning of my stitching. And then I saw an antique sampler in an antique shop, and it was too expensive, and discovered that I could stitch my own reproduction by a chart and stitch it. So I decided to do that and just became hooked and have probably stitched over 100 or more since then. I've just been obsessed with antique samplers for almost 40 years.
Oh. Well, take me back to the quilting. Was that in the days? Because now we have several quilts that my grandma made, but it was always old shirts and things that she would cut out to get the pieces for the quilt. Is that how you did quilts?
It wasn't that old. In the 80s, back then there were some pattern books. And there used to be a small fabric shop that was owned by Old German Baptists. Are you familiar with them?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. There's a lot of Old German Baptists in this area. And they, of course, make all their own clothes and had all the reproduction type fabrics long, 20, 30 years before everyone else discovered reproduction fabrics.
Oh, okay.
So I bought the pattern and the fabrics from them.
Okay.
And that was my first quilt.
hand quilted?
The first one I did. I didn't know of any alternative.
Okay.
The recent ones, few of them I've sent out to somebody with a long arm machine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way to go, isn't it?
Uh-huh. And if they're smaller, I've done them myself on my sewing machine, but I don't have a long arm. I just have a regular Singer sewing machine.
Yeah, those long arms, my stepmother owned one of those things. Boy, that's a whole different world there, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're pretty pricey, way over $1,000.
Yes. Yeah, that part too. Yeah. I couldn't believe how big it was, though. She had it down in the basement. And what is that? And she explained what it was. And then I asked, and I said, how much? And she said, never mind.
Yes.
Yeah. So the stitching then was really just kind of a lark then for you, right?
Yes, it was. I taught myself. I just picked it up and thought it was great fun and got into making a reproduction and just thought it was wonderful. And then back then discovered Scarlet Letter, who was, I think, the very first around.
Uh-huh.
And the most beautiful things I'd ever seen, and decided, well, okay, I'm going to figure out how to do this because I want to make one of these. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. Well, I will say that, and I blame it all on Nicola, I've gotten hooked on these reproduction samplers. It's a world I really didn't know existed. There were a couple of times here, 4 or 5 years ago, that I bought that with that sampler monthly or quarterly magazine.
Oh, yes, I've got every single issue.
Do you?
Of that.
Yeah, I bought two of them just for something to read and to see what that was about. But I never really connected with it. I didn't get it. And now I get it fully, and it's rather addictive.
Yes, it is. And there are so many beautiful ones out. There's too many to choose from, and you never have. Even if I wasn't stitching my own models, there's never enough time to do everything that I want.
Right. And I've been amazed. I will be amazed for some time, I'm sure, that there are so many originals available.
Yes.
You just would not think that over time, 200 years, give or take, that so many would have survived. But it's just amazing to me.
Considering all that people say today about the acid-free materials and don't let it touch the glass and museum glass and everything else, and yet these old samplers were nailed to dirty wood boards. And they're still around.
Yep. Yep, durable stuff. So what was your, you started stitching, but when did you get your first sampler to reproduce?
Oh, gee. I probably started buying some antique samplers maybe 9 or 10 years ago.
Okay.
And then I think my first reproduction was 2014 or 2015.
Oh, so relatively recent then.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I've just been doing this for, say, 4 years,
okay.
I think.
So your first ones, did you get them through auction or estate sales? How'd you find them?
Oh, a few have been online through auctions. And a few have been from local antique stores. And where else? I think mostly I don't travel much. So either from online auctions and local antique stores.
Yeah.
There are several nice antique stores in Tip City.
And you're on the list if a sampler comes in, call you?
Yes. Yes, I am.
It fascinates me. I've talked to other reproduction people. When you get an original, the process. Talk about the process when you get one. I assume it comes most of the time. They come mounted or framed in some way, and you need to take them apart.
Yes. Let's see. One I took apart because the glass was so dirty.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't believe the difference in the colors after I took it apart. I've always been a little hesitant to take them apart because one that I reproduced was framed. And I took it apart, and it had actually, it was one that I sent you a picture of, Marianne Mitten.
Uh-huh.
And when I took it apart, the verse, the black stitches, which it was, it's a long three paragraph verse, and it was in black. And fortunately, I had done a lot of photographs before I took it apart.
Oh.
Because the black stitches must have just been sitting on top, and that's all that was left of the verse.
Oh, my.
And when I handled it, it literally disappeared.
Oh, that must have been a sick feeling.
Yes. But like I said, I did have all the photographs, so I was able to reproduce it. It's just not something that I can frame the antique and display because right. There's just nothing left.
Right.
So if I don't have to, I'm hesitant to do that because I'm not an expert and I'm afraid I'll mess something up.
Yeah, one experience like that, that'll cure you.
Yes. And you just can't handle them.
Yeah.
Even though it looks like the stitches are intact, they might not be. They might just fall away into the air.
Right. What is it that attracts you? What makes you buy a sampler? I've heard others say they speak to me. Is it that?
Yes,
or do you...
They do. I'd say they either, or there's even one small thing on it that I like.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's horses on it, that will say attract me, and
okay.
I'll notice that. Or maybe it's the verse, or the colors, or maybe even a couple deer, but there's like something on it that just really gets me.
Okay. So it really is. So when people say they speak to me, same for you then. And just
yes.
Something about it, and I got to do that one. I got to have that one. Yeah.
Yes, because you can see, like you said, there are quite a few still left.
Yeah.
And you can just look at one after another. You might look at, see 100 Scottish house samplers with a Scottish mansion in the middle
mm-hmm.
from the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. And yet the one that I reproduced, the Mary Inglis, it had this bright blue roof, and that just got to me.
Yeah.
Or one I bought because her name was my maiden name, and another, her name was Evans, which was my great-grandmother's maiden name, and then she named my father Evan, and then I named my son Evan. So that spoke to me.
Yeah, got to have that one, you bet.
It can be just little things, usually.
Mm-hmm. That's fun. It's just interesting because you see that with other needlework. People say, well, I got to do that one because I like it. But with reproduction samplers, it's always, they speak to me, and then if you dig in a little deeper, there's almost always a personal connection that in some
yeah.
way or other that makes them yeah. makes them speak. I guess it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I think with everybody who buys the antique samplers, there has to be something personal that really gets to them, or you just be overwhelmed with all the choices and what to buy. Do you want to
right.
go American or European or Victorian or 18th century? What style do you like, et cetera?
Yeah. When you go to chart them, does everybody, it seems like everybody kind of has the same process. You just sit there with a magnifier and
yes.
software, and you just, it's just tedious detail work, working your way back and forth.
Yes, it's very detailed, but it's very addicting. I can be charting a sampler, and I have to force myself to stop, or else I
okay.
just keep on charting until 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. And if I don't force myself to stop by 8 or 9 o'clock and relax and stitch for myself for a couple hours, I know that I'll never go to sleep because my mind will be too wound up. And you just always think, okay, I just want to do one last motif or one last inch going down.
Yep.
It's addicting.
Yeah. So, okay. If I want to sleep tonight, I got to quit by 8. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Cause that, the challenge, I mean, I obviously it's a challenge in terms of simply counting threads, but there's got to be other things when you're charting that are challenging. Sometimes difficult to see where stitches begin and end, or what do you deal with?
Picking the colors, I think, is challenging. And so many of these girls did not stitch exactly over two threads like we do today.
Oh.
And it's very difficult to make the sampler come out to be a perfect reproduction where when she would stitch over two, and then one, and then two, one, and keep, you know, little mistakes, I assume.
Yeah.
And yet you have to make it transfer to stitching over two.
Yes. And she's also a kid. You know, that's the thing, is they're all kids, you know. And
they made lots of mistakes. I many times have looked at a sampler, and also on stitching, when you are stitching a border, you think, oh, that looks the same. And you just go on and go down the page and work away at your border. And then you figure out that one place was 10 stitches instead of 11 stitches, and you have to rip the whole thing out.
Yep.
And these girls, you know, made so many mistakes like that. It's easy to make a mistake like that in charting, too.
Uh-huh.
Because even with a magnifier, a lot of the colors are hard to see. And some of them are stitched on such fine, like 50, 60 count linen.
Yeah.
That it's very hard to count the stitches and easy to make a mistake in the charting.
Young eyes.
Yeah. And they were doing it by just daylight or candlelight.
I know. Young eyes.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's one thing I learned in the one sampler that I've done extensive work on, is that human nature where these are all the same. So I'll just, you know, put the chart aside and just stitch them. And then I've been burnt more than once already.
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm off by two. Where did that happen? Oh, it's over here. These were not the same. Yeah.
I no longer will stitch an entire border. And when I see people online on Facebook that are stitching a very large sampler and have completed the entire border first and it comes together, I'm just in awe of them, because I won't do that anymore. I'll do the border across and maybe down an inch, and then fill in so that I've got motifs to make sure that everything lines up before just going on with the border. Because if I don't do that, I'll definitely make a mistake.
Yeah, see, that's interesting. These borders, the more I've explored it, the more the borders play such a role in things. Because when we're doing the Hands Across the Seas Sarah Brazier stitch along, and when I did the video that I did with Jean Lee at the Attic, and we were talking about the border, and her advice was to do exactly what you do.
Yes.
To start with a border and then carry elements along, mm-hmm. so that you always have something to relate to. But then when we talked to Jacqueline Morris, who stitched the model, then she stitched the border by doing an X and then 9 half crosses and then an X all the way around, so she could count and completed the border and made it meet up, and then went back and stitched things. So it's interesting to hear different people take different approaches. And
she's a far superior stitcher to myself then. Do that.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but it's just interesting, because especially on big ones, to get all the way down to the lower right corner and toward the end and have them not meet up, and then have to fudge or something to make it meet up. What frustration that must be.
Yes.
Yeah.
We all learn the hard way.
Yeah, that's the way to learn, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep, there's no magical technology that can save you. Yeah. So the talk about, people are always interested in what people's stitching area is like. Talk about what, do you have a room or wherever you want?
Mine is just in a wingback chair in my family room with my Ott light next to me. Nothing fancy, and it's in across from the TV, and I'm usually not watching TV, but more just listening to it in the background.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fancy stitching room or area. It's just a wingback chair.
All right. Yeah, that TV thing, I was stitching this past weekend and wanted something on TV, and I thought, well, I'll watch a movie. And I was looking for a movie that I had seen so I wouldn't have to look up much. And then a movie I knew had a lot of dialogue and couldn't find one. And finally, I was on Netflix and I just listened to comedian shows.
Yes.
Because then I knew I wouldn't have to look up. And because you got to, that's the TV thing is nice if you can look up occasionally. But yeah, sometimes I'd just soon not.
Yes. And if I look up at the TV, not only will I perhaps lose my concentration and my place, but if my eyes focus on the television screen for a few minutes, when I look back down, it's going to take 10 minutes or so for them to readjust and refocus to the stitching.
Yeah. Do you use a magnifier?
No, I have never. I just recently bit the bullet and purchased a small one. If I absolutely have to use it, say, with an over one verse.
Okay.
So I have not stitched. I can't see with just my eyes to stitch on the 40 count. I would say 32 is my favorite. 36, I can manage. Anything above that, I'm going to have to use a magnifier, and I just haven't wanted to. I'm getting, of course, my eyes are getting worse, not better. I'm going to get to the point where I have to, but so far I haven't reached that point yet.
Yeah. Now, I was watching a couple of FlossTube videos and people stitching on 36, 40 count linen without any magnifier or anything and stitching in hand. And I just can't even comprehend how that gets done. And just stitching along and talking and, I'd have so many mistakes. I'd just throw it in the basket, but
yeah,
for me, it's a scroll frame and a magnifier with LED lights on it. And my eyes aren't that bad, but that's just the way I do it. I don't know why. It's just easier on me. So,
yes.
Use a scroll frame or you stitch in hand?
I have had my same, like 6-inch wooden German hoop or English.
Excellent.
It's one of these Hardwick hoops from the very beginning. When I first started stitching, that's all I've ever used. And recently I purchased some of those, I think they're called Q-snaps. They're like,
yep.
Four sides of white plastic stuff.
Right. Yeah. Q snaps. Yep.
They make a square frame.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I tried those and I guess I'm too set in my ways. It made my hand cramp and I just couldn't get used to it. So I guess I'll give them to someone who wants them and stick with the same thing I've been using for years.
That's a great mental image right there, because I can see that hoop has got to be worn absolutely smooth, I would think.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And it's, of course, I have it wrapped with bias tape to make it hold better. Yeah. And it's been wrapped and rewrapped many times. But it was a good imported one, not one of the cheap ones that you get at a craft store. And it's lasted me all these years, and I'm sure it will last me till the end of my days.
Yeah. Well, and that really speaks to, because I have a couple of those Hardwick hoops, and I don't use them much because I use scroll frame and on a stand. But it really speaks to getting what you pay for, because think about all the years and all the stitches you've made with that one hoop. And if you'd bought a cheap one, you'd have thrown it away 40 times, you know?
And how many times have I screwed and unscrewed that little screw? It still works wonderfully.
Yeah, no, it's worth it. Those tools, it's worth it to spend that extra money. Seems like a lot up front, but over the long term, it's really just pennies. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great mental image. Just sitting there in your wing chair with a well-worn hoop, just stitching away.
I'll tell you something about me and my house. Since it's an antique house, and I'm also obsessed with antiques and everything old. So therefore, I won't allow any new highfangled equipment, stitching or otherwise, in my house. That's why I don't have a comfy recliner or something like that, because everything has to look the part and look like an antique house.
Okay. Nothing wrong with that.
I do have a little portable Otlight that I use, but it's one of those small little portable ones that you can put away and hide when you're not using.
Uh-huh. What would we do without Otlights?
Uh-huh.
Oh boy. You get to a stitching retreat or something, and all those lights come out, and it's like, whoa, that's a store full of them.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So walls covered with stitching?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Like,
wallpapered with samplers, practically.
There we go. There we go.
Every room of the house. And this isn't including all my models, because they are all framed without glass, and I don't hang them anywhere because they're periodically going, you know, being shipped places into different shops. So, and then if I had them on the walls, I'd have to take them down and put something else up. So they're just all in little fabric bags I've made for them, just sitting on the floor.
Now, do you stitch all your models, or do you have people help you?
No, I stitch them all.
So you're a one-woman band here, the whole bit.
Yes, that's why I only come out with two, say, a year.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I do all the printing and photographing and everything, too.
Oh, my. Everything.
Yes.
Yeah. So then you got to be, when you stitch the model, you have to be your own worst critic in a big way to make sure that you have it just right.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess except for the models, I am not a total perfectionist. As far as, yes, I know it's a reproduction and it has to be exact. But if I'm stitching something just for myself, not my models, and I make a mistake, I just make it work. Because too many times I have been ripping out and ripped a hole in the linen and just ruined things.
Uh-huh.
So unless it's a model, if I can possibly make it work, I will. And actually, if you're just stitching a reproduction sampler for yourself, they're very forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have one extra stitch or one less stitch or be off a stitch, and no one's ever gonna know, because the girls made so many mistakes.
Yeah.
It's not like some of the modern completely filled in designs that if you make a mistake, the whole thing's gonna be off.
Right, right. Well, those full coverage pieces, I am always amazed at people who stitch those. I have no idea how they do that. And then people who have 15 or 20 thread colors going at once. That's amazing to me.
And yet they'll look at a large reproduction sampler and think it looks so difficult. And I think the solidly stitched things, like someone who is stitching, for example, a solidly stitched dog where they're making all the shadings and everything.
Yep.
I think that is much more difficult than a reproduction sampler.
Oh, yeah. To me, that's three levels more difficult.
Yeah.
especially when you have what they call confetti, where you've got one X here and one over here, and they're all the same color. I'm just amazed at people who can do that. There was somebody who finished one. It was a reproduction of a painting, and they had posted on Facebook the other day that they had finished it. And I just kind of sat there. I'm sure my jaw was halfway to the floor. All that shading, all that detail, and then my mind is just going in close, all those little X's, and it just is amazing to me that, number one, that people can do it, but two, that they have the perseverance to finish one of those. Boy.
Yes, I've done needlepoint pictures, which mm-hmm. is similar as far as the shading and the many different colors. Much more difficult.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I remember those days. Yes.
Yes.
Basket weave till you scream. Yes.
Yes.
Tell me about, I'm always curious to learn about, you talked about the challenge of the colors when you're doing a sampler. And I'm always curious to hear from people who do the reproduction samplers. It seems like there's an aspect of art to deciding what colors to use, but then sometimes it's just the back. You look at the back side and you can see exactly what the color was. What goes through your mind when you're figuring out those colors?
I am more of a person to chart from the front.
Okay.
Because I like the old antique look. And quite often the backs were so bright and gaudy to my yeah. eyes now. So I will always chart from the front, but it's still, usually when I chart, I'll start out on the software with just picking, say, if I need green, I just pick a green and a red, and then go through and chart the motifs. And then after I've got all that done, I will go back in and search for the exact same shade or the exact shade that I want and change it to what I want.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because so, once I start on the linen, and this, of course, is after I've chosen the linen for the reproduction, because for me, at least, if I pick colors to begin with and then think they look great and then start stitching on the linen that I've chosen, they're not going to look great. There's going to be something wrong. It's going to be too green or not gray enough or something that I just need to wait until I'm ready to actually stitch thread on linen so that I can choose the exact color.
Mm-hmm. See, that's interesting to me. Because see, when you say the backside is too bright and gaudy, and then because I always wonder when the girls stitched the originals, you know, I assume that it was a white or an off-white linen that they started mm-hmm. with.
All these hand-dyed linens today, we're trying to emulate the old look of a sampler that's been exposed for a couple hundred years.
Yes. Yes. And I find that an interesting approach because in my naive little mind, you would want to get back to how it was originally, which would be white with the bright colors, whatever the colors are, instead of that older antique look. But that's a rare person that does that.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people who like that. I just, like I said, I'm obsessed with all things antique.
Yeah, I suppose a white linen gaudy colored thing in an antique house would just not be a good fit. No.
Yes.
No. So linen, 32 count, and then DMC floss, silks?
Not silks. I've been using mostly gentle arts.
Okay.
Before I started using them, I just used good old DMC. I know many people love silk, but personally, I think once you're a foot or two away, you can't tell the difference.
Okay.
I know many people, there are those that would disagree with that, but I think good old DMC is just fine. And yep. Also, You don't have to be so careful of not wasting your thread because it's so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you drop a big hunk and the cat gets it, it's no big deal.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day, where I think many days we just take DMC for granted because it is relatively inexpensive.
Yeah.
There's such an incredible array of colors, mm-hmm. and it's available anywhere.
Yes.
And yet, you take that out of the hobby. You know, just take DMC right out of the hobby. You can't have it.
Uh-huh.
And I think the hobby would be in trouble.
Yes. There might not even be a hobby.
Yeah. And for that, all from one company.
Yes.
And with all the threads and all the fibers of all kinds that we have available today, it's still the very spine of the hobby.
Yes, when I started, I'm sure there were silks, but I did not know of them.
Mm-hmm.
Just this enormous array of DMC, and that's what I've used for 40 years.
Yeah, and it still serves, yep.
Yes, it's still just as good.
Yep.
And their colors don't vary. I just think it's a great thread.
Yeah, and I think, that's the other part of it, is they really have it locked down and terms of dye lots, and there's just a consistency across the board and color fast and just all the basics that we need. And I was just thinking, what if we didn't have that? Where would we be? And I couldn't find a pretty picture for that.
I think the stitching business never would have developed. No, there wouldn't have been designers. There wouldn't be all these linens. People wouldn't be stitching them because there just wouldn't, it wouldn't be.
Yeah.
I guess we'd be quilting or knitting or something else. I just don't think there would be stitching.
Right. Yeah. No, I really don't know how it would happen. Because even you can take all your silks and overdyed threads and everything, and I don't know that there's any other line of product that can offer all the subtle little shadings that you have with DMC. Maybe a couple of silk lines are pretty close.
Yes.
But you know, you take green. I mean, you just take the green spectrum that DMC offers, and
yes,
every green you can imagine, and then some.
They have a color for everything.
Yes.
Now, I also really like the gentle arch threads. I know a lot of people are critical of how much the dye lots change. But mm-hmm. for reproduction samplers and for the look that I like, I hoard different dye lots.
Ah.
If the dye lot changes, that's a good thing because that just adds to the faded look or the old look.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a positive. So that doesn't bother me a bit that the dye lots seem to change a lot.
How do you end up with gentle arts?
He saw me, actually they're just over in Columbus, Ohio, which isn't far from me. But
that helps.
He saw my blog, I think. And I had posting of the samplers I was designing or reproducing. And he contacted me and just asked if I was interested and sent me some of his floss, and I just started using it.
Hmm.
And it works out great because if I run out, it gets here in a day or two because they're so close to me.
Yeah, yeah. Keeps you supplied.
Yes. And I do like cotton better than silk, as I said.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and looking through your, I was intrigued by the one Lilius Davidson.
Oh.
Where it's done in wool.
Yes, that's Gentle Arts wool too.
Okay.
That's from them also.
Okay. How'd you get that sampler?
That's the one that I purchased online because Davidson was my middle name.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me, Davidson was my maiden name.
Uh-huh.
So that's what, like I said, there's always a little something that attracts you to everything.
And that was all done in wool, huh?
Yes, that's because if the original sampler was all done in wool, which quite a few of the Scottish samplers were, or the mid-1800s Scottish samplers, and the Welsh samplers also, which are later 1800s, and I refer to them, which I got the term from a lady named Mary Jenkins, who is online and has written books on Welsh quilts and samplers and lives in Wales and is pretty much the expert on all things Welsh.
Yeah.
And she says that Welsh folk art samplers are more like folk art than to be judged as stitching, because they're stitched in wool and they're stitched on a smaller count linen and not nearly as detailed as, say, the English samplers would be. They're more like the Lilias Davidson. It's just more childish, and I think it's on like a 28 or 30 count linen with wool and not big any, and it's not large and fancy and involved.
Hmm.
Although it's Scottish, but
now that old wool thread, when you got that, held up better. It was in good shape.
I love the wools. Now, you can't use them on larger counts. Say, I wouldn't use them on above a 32 count, because then I think it would fray.
Okay.
But the samplers that were stitched in wool are, the original was stitched on, say, between a 25 and 32 count.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, of course, what you do the reproduction on. And if it was done in wool, I'd like to reproduce it in wool.
Right.
But the nice thing is, of course, the wools are more expensive, is that the Gentle Art line of wool colors is the same as the line of their cotton colors, their sampler threads.
Oh.
Now, there aren't as many wool colors, but if it's in the wool, and I use the wool, you can also do it in just the cotton Gentle Arch threads, which is probably about a third of the cost.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, also I put a DMC conversion on there, so if somebody wants to convert it further, you can also do it in DMC.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Wool easier to stitch with than cotton?
Not easier, I wouldn't say, but you use one thread, which is nice. Mm-hmm. On cotton, with the cottons, I always use two, unless you get up to like 36 count. And at 36 count, it's kind of hard to decide between one or two strands of cotton. You're kind of in the gray area. Once you'd be up to 40 count, it'd definitely be just one thread.
Yeah. Yeah, 36 seems to be where everybody seems to ask the question, do I do one or two?
Yeah. I think at 36, it just sort of depends on what you think looks the best.
Yeah.
How you like it to look.
Yeah. The only wool I ever did was when I first started needlepointing, you know, and that.
Yeah.
Was it Paternaen? Is that what it is?
Yes.
Yeah. That's all I ever knew. Yeah.
The Gentle Arch wool threads are much thinner than that.
I would hope so.
Yes. It's a completely different type of wool than what we used to needlepoint with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So what's next for Mary Wynn Farm? You got one on the in the hoop that's coming up?
Yes, I'm working on stitching a model for another Welsh folk art sampler.
Oh.
And her name is Leah Gronow, and it's 1872. Mm-hmm. And I'm about halfway through the model. So I would hope that within 2 or 3 months, it should be out.
Okay. And then people find out about that through your blog, and then they get the charts through stores, right?
Yes, either through stores or through me. I have a Facebook, Mary Wynn Farm, also, and I'm in all the various sampler groups that I'm sure you're in online.
Yep.
And I always advertise on there, and advertise my blog on there. And then, of course, I do the 50% wholesale to shops. And I have maybe 6 or 7 or 8 that are on my automatic list, and then other shops that I sell to also. But I also, I have an Etsy shop too. I sell the charts through there also.
Yeah. Yeah.
All my charts are on my Etsy shop.
Yes, I've poured through that. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Are you seeing a growing interest in reproduction samplers, or is it fairly stable?
To me, I'm so isolated, it's hard to say. I personally think that it sort of seems to be a core group of people who have been hooked on reproduction samplers for years, or and still are. People like me who started doing it and still love to do it. I don't really know how many people are getting into stitching the reproductions, because I think you have to like antiques and everything old to stitch a reproduction sampler. And younger people who do more what I would call the cutesy designs, and I don't mean that derogatorily, but I just can't see so much the younger crowd getting into antiques in general. As you know, antiques aren't selling well anymore. And I think reproductions of antique samplers are kind of in that category. Seems like younger people would rather go to Pottery Barn and buy a pine reproduction and spend more money than they could buy the real thing for.
Yeah.
You agree? What do you think about that?
Well, the reason I ask is that I am just, it seems to be such a strong area of the needlework community, strong and active with a lot of dedicated people all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's just hard for me to gauge if that's because that's the nature of the beast, or if it's because it's growing. And the majority of people I talk to seem to be incredibly dedicated to reproduction samplers. And you know, I'm an absolute rookie at it. And I immediately saw how addicting it can be. And I enjoy stitching what little I've done so far. And it's that, you know, when you finish a motif, that one's done. Yay. And to see that build up, and there's so much variety in the reproductions, even though you're just making X's, so much variety. And, you know, I learned early on when I slogged through an alphabet, don't do that. Do a few letters and go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you bounce around, and it, to me, it's just a lot of fun to do. And you can stitch something in an hour and complete it and move on to the next thing. So I just find them really enjoyable, but I'm not young either. So it's,
I would hope that it would grow. I would hope that the younger generation's entire outlook into anything historical would grow.
Yeah, I would hope so too, and we've talked with other people about how we're tending to see a trend where young people are starting to look up from their phones and say, "Wait a minute, you know what? Let me do something productive with my time that's enjoyable," and
yes.
And a lot of younger people are finding needlework as one of those options. And
yes, and you can make something so lovely for yourself.
Yes.
But
yes.
Like I said, when I first started, I wanted an antique sampler and couldn't buy it. Therefore, I made it. Now, back then, if you wanted something and you couldn't get it, you made it.
Right.
I can't see my 25-year-old son thinking to himself, "I want that, so therefore I'm going to make myself a copy." That's just not how
right
his mind works.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Whether they do it or not, it's sure a pleasure to sit there for hours and just stitch away.
It is.
Awful relaxing. All right, Melinda, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it. And thanks to everybody for listening. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.